Coming up, it's Counterculture with Marie Buskey. A look into the world of critical social justice, woke culture, and more on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, or even if you don't agree with what you're listening to, then get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057. Or if you'd rather email us, you can at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so get in touch with us now.
Good morning and welcome to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio. I'm your host, Marie Buskey, and this is the place where we discuss the issues through a cultural lens and how ideologies are impacting our everyday lives. I have an entertainment-inspired morning for you today. First up, I speak with Vaishnavi Sundar, a documentary filmmaker, writer, producer, and director. We discuss her latest release, Behind the Looking Glass. It's a compelling work looking at the largely ignored and untold stories of wives and children left behind in the wake of their husbands and fathers who become trans-identified men. Then it's time to have Hercules in the house. Yep, last week, I managed to snatch some time to chat with legendary Hercules actor Kevin Sorbo from his home in Florida. We talk about his cancellation from Hollywood for being a conservative Christian and how this has forced him to pivot to start telling and making his own uplifting films for more conservative audiences. And then the conversation sort of morphed into golf and politics and tales of a president or two. It was a fun conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Welcome to Kiwi Farm. Established 1840. Shoei Salbrook hated chickens. She'd grown to despise them, distrust them. For Shoei, the chickens were a constant reminder. For all the free ranger success at the last election, it was due to the chickens that she occupied a seat on the farmhouse table. That was not a position of power, but one of sniping, exasperation, and derision. For Shoei, the chickens were a subversive force on Kiwi Farm that needed to be tamed and brought back into line. But Shoei was starting to see a kernel of an idea develop, seeded by a story she'd received from the sheep on Old Blighty Farm, the original home farm. Backyard chicken brood over vital bird register, the missive read. It appeared the new comrade in charge of Blighty Farm, a pig by the name of Kiel Stasi, had implemented a chicken registry, tracking every single bird in every single paddock out of a fear that they could spread a disease, akin to the Great Sickness, which plunged all animals into fear just a handful of years ago. Shoei marvelled at the plan's brilliance. It was the chickens who had led a dogged resistance against all the measures that many farms, including Aotearoa Farm as it was known then, had been a feathery thorn in Shoei's side for years. Mother hens were once revered on the farm. They selflessly raised and cared for new broods, all while continuing to lay and produce wealth for Kiwi Farm. The hens were a powerful political force too, and had long been steadfast supporters of both Napoleon's crew and the free rangers alike. Their gentle nature and empathy made them loyal allies, and their willingness to trust anything uttered out of the lips of Napoleon was extremely useful at the beginning of the Great Sickness outbreak, and then latterly the subsequent drenching campaign. However, not all hens were on board. A small clutch of feisty avians seemed immune to Napoleon and her hypnotic oratory. They had the audacity to ask questions. Cluck, 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 they questioned. probed, started rallying support from a variety of other animals who were growing tired of the measures imposed. Even banishment to the paddocks at the height of the drenching campaign didn't appear to quell those plucky avians. It emboldened them. And to add insult to injury, they found support in the form of the old donkey Winnie Ben. And the cunning old mule made haste to rally the cause with his uncanny sense of timing. And just like that, after a short campaign, the old donkey was back in the farmhouse, occupying the seat that Showy believed should have been hers. Showy hated the chickens. And these measures implemented by Keel Stasi over on Blighty Farm could have legs to finally shut these chickens up for good. Showy and a number of her colleagues had long infiltrated the machinery of the farm's administration. They had managed to pass new rules and even control any animal that had a whiff of sympathy for the chickens into submission through censorship and censure. But even then, these chickens persisted. How dare they claim that boars can't be sows and bulls aren't cows? So perhaps this register is just what Kiwi Farm needed. But how to get this implemented was another challenge indeed. Kiwi Farm needed a disaster, a new sickness, something so big it scared all the wavering animals straight, well, not too straight, just on the straight and narrow to obedience, and the horizontal policing should take care of the rest. But first, she needed to shut those bloody chickens up. They had now started their own news distribution system that usurped the sheep, and animals were tuning out the sheep and listening to the chickens. If restrictions to shut them up have failed, perhaps registering them would do the trick. Showy got out pen and paper and started a letter. Dear Comrade Keel, tune in next week to Kiwi Farm for the latest developments, exclusively here on Counterculture on Chicken, Reality Check Radio.
This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here with Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now from Chennai in India is Vaishnavi Sundar. I have just watched the most incredible documentary made by you called Behind the Looking Glass, and it is such a great honour to have you here this morning. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Marie. I really appreciate it.
Look, just before we started, I had to say to you, I had a little bit of a boo-hoo. It was so moving. Explain to our listeners what Behind the Looking Glass is and what prompted you to make such a powerful piece of film.
Thank you so much for your kind words. Behind the Looking Glass took nearly 3 years to make, and it was a result of a thought I had when I was editing my previous film. The previous film that I made is a four-part documentary called Dysphoric, and it is on the rise of gender identity ideology and the need for young women to want to opt for transition. So while I was editing that, I had often thought about what would it be like for the family members of these girls who I was interviewing. Now, because I'm only interested in telling the stories of women, I did consider briefly what would it be like for women who are wives and partners, if their male spouses say something like this, and what would happen to children and things like that. The thought kind of lingered in the back of my mind and never really put that into action, because I believed like films come to you, they pick you, you don't pick them. So when I finished Dysphoric and I was doing something else, this idea came to my mind and I started researching. And the title hadn't come to me at all either. I believe that also kind of like, it just hits you one day. And while I was editing, I realized that there's a lot of looking into the mirror and a lot of narcissism, a lot of projection, literal and metaphorical, and in a very emotional, abusive way. So then I thought, because there's a lot of mirror reference going on, what would it be like for me to imply that behind all of this glitz and stunning and brave and all of that, what's really going down in households where men one day just wake up and say that I'm going to identify as a woman, you're now my lesbian wife. So that's the long and short of it.
Yeah. So this story is, you've gathered together a large number of women who identify themselves as trans widows, which I think is a really apt description. And they come from all walks of life. That's what I really found so fascinating, from everyday housewives to women, older women, through to academics, through to women of all religions. It seems to be a universal problem that is spread across the world. How did you initially gather these women together?
Actually, the number that you see, the number of women that you see in the film, is not the total number of women that I interviewed or researched. I spoke to nearly 40 to 50 women. Some of them had to make a choice to not be part of the final film for very obvious reasons, like threats from their exes and things like that. But the final set of women that did choose to be on the film, it just so happened that their age groups were diverse, their qualifications were very diverse, and the things that happened to them, though there is like a commonality between all of them, were also quite different. Some of them had children, some of them didn't, some of them were in their 70s when they talked to me, and the information that they were sharing were things that happened to them when they were in their 20s and 30s. And there were women who were in their 20s and 30s talking to me now about their experience. So I realized that this is a telltale sign to make everybody understand that this is not a Western phenomenon. This is not an American or a British phenomenon. It is a worldwide phenomenon. And it happens to women across the board. Because there is also a section where I specifically say that there's a misnomer, right? Because these kind of things happen to a specific kind of women or something like that. Mm. But it can't happen to me. It happens to them. Now, until you become them, you realize it basically happens to just about anybody. When I used to be married, I'm not now. When I went through the divorce, I thought the period that was just about the time when I was about to get divorced, it felt like a movie. I was watching myself go through this experience because it didn't seem like something like this could happen to me at all. But because it's me, how could it happen to me? And then, of course, the same exact thought probably lingered in the minds of all of these women that I had spoken with. So I thought it was phenomenal of these women to come forward and talk about these experiences. Because I was listening to that over and over again, sometimes one story blurred into another. So I used to get like dreams and things like that. I used to wake up in the middle of the night with an editing idea that I want to put these two clips together because it would complement each other really well and things like that. So basically 3 years of my life was just basically listening to these stories over and over and hopefully make this into a documentary which people would watch and understand that there's just an alternative perspective we're throwing out to the world because we're so carried away by the woke ideology and the gender ideology where we're not allowed to even consider the possibility that this might happen to women. So that was the effort. And the title was basically a result of these men being extremely taken to their own reflection in the mirror.
One of the themes that hit me like a train was the theme of abuse. And it has been accepted for a long time that male abuse within a marriage, whether it be mental or physical abuse, is something that should not be accepted. And yet, those same themes, those same mechanisms were being played out and told by these women again and again and again. And now these men are rejoiced, lauded and affirmed. How do you reconcile that? I mean, as a filmmaker, when you're making that, is that something that you saw and you wanted to highlight? Or was it just something you weren't expecting to see?
Well, I did expect to see something like this in terms of male behavior, not necessarily just because there's trans ideology tied to this, but in general, male behavior is male behavior. And we've seen this we've lived our lives as women in this world, so we know a thing or two about male behavior towards us. So a lot of things that these women were describing were not things that shocked me or surprised me one bit. I was horrified. I was mortified, but it did not surprise me at all. Coming to terms with the abuse that these men were constantly putting their wives through was something that was really hard for me to put together as a film, because it's already going to be judged as a transphobic film, right? Because I've made it. People aren't going to even come meet us in the middle here and, you know, have like a level playing field in discussing. Well, you talk about your thing. Let me talk about mine. We're never going to have that opportunity. But despite that, I tried my best to put forward this abuse section in a way that these are not women who are sitting and bawling their eyes out, though that's how they must have felt when it was all going down. But these are women that are describing as experiences that happened to them, but not as experiences that define them. So I couldn't reconcile with the fact that somehow these men were able to get away with this purely because they now self-identify as trans. Some kind of an exclusion that you probably will not be afforded if it was a regular garden variety kind of domestic abuse. Though I should say that being in India, I know that the rates of conviction is abysmally low when it comes to regular domestic violence. We have pending cases in Supreme Court in upwards of thousands that women have still not had their day in court. So I can imagine how it is even harder, given that those are the stunning and brave people and we are the horrible monsters and witches and whatnot. So it was doubly pressurizing for me to put forth a viewpoint that doesn't look like it is weaponizing anybody, although that is exactly what I'm doing. I'm pointing out male violence against women. But I tried to make it in a way that when you watch it, it hits you, but you're not weeping. You're angry. You feel like the film wants you to do something about this. This is so unfair. How can this happen to these women? You know, you feel enraged in a way that you want to make your voice heard, make your thoughts heard. I thought that was my goal, because if we are just going to speak in some vacuums and different corners of the world, we're not going to be able to make any difference at all. So film is my way of provoking everyone to come forward and speak their mind about what they are thinking about this issue. Is it fair that these women are put through this just because their abusers are now trans-identified? Those are the questions that I was asking with my film. And it is up to the audience to take it in and decide for themselves how they want to respond to the subject, to the film, to the ideology, everything.
I also think if you are a woman in an abusive relationship with a regular man, not even a trans man, that you would actually find that very powerful itself, because you explain so beautifully just that. You explain all the mechanisms for abuse that can go on. And it was the gaslighting, you know, that of them telling you one thing. There was a girl, one of the women, who talked about her journaling, and she stopped journaling because her husband was reading her journals. And then he was trying to convince her of things that she'd said or done. And she was certain she hadn't done those things, but he was convincing her that she was. And I mean, that is absolutely archetypal of the genesis of gaslighting and one of the abusive ploys that takes place. So I guess, to your point, men, you're right not to be surprised, because we know what men behaving badly looks like. Just because they're wearing lipstick, stilettos and a dress doesn't mean that they're going to stop behaving badly, does it?
It does not change a thing. And this kind of gaslighting is something that we experience day in and day out, even outside of this ideology. The governments gaslight us. Industries gaslight us. You know, parents and siblings and neighbors. And it's basically a relationship that you're just all too familiar with. It's almost maddening to survive in a place that is constantly telling you to not go with what you can see and hear with your own eyes and ears. And it is, I think, one of the most cruel form of violence Of course, there is no way one can compare all the different kinds of violence we can go through. But this one is particularly baffling because it's like an entire society telling you to disbelieve what you can see to be the truth. And I think being unable to say that, no, you're all wrong, I think is one of the most painful things for the person who's experiencing it. Because you know you're right and they are all wrong. And you're not allowed to say it. And that sort of a gagging, I think, happens within the house where this wife is stuck in a marriage with a trans-identified man. I think that happens to a general person in the world as a feminist, as a person who's critical of this ideology. Social media is doing the same thing to us. Basically, it goes from micro to macro and it's all the same.
I talk a lot about cancel culture, and this really is a cancellation within the home. You're either on board or you're cancelled. And the abuse can be mental or physical in some cases. Children, explain how the elements with children are brought in, because I know you spoke to a number of mothers in this situation and they had some very powerful things to say.
Oh, goodness. I can't even imagine being a child with a trans-identified parent. I mean, the amount of mind control that you will be subjected to in order for you to one day just stop calling your dad, dad. I grew up in an abusive household. My father was physically violent. He was terrorizing my mother. And I know how it feels to be in a house like that. It's like the little things, you know, based on the way your father removes his footwear, whether tonight's going to be one of those really bad nights. You know this so well, and you're just a child. You probably don't even have the vocabulary to articulate it, but yet innately, you just know these things deep down. And I think it's so unfair for children to have these things as part of their, I don't know, survival mechanisms. Children should be children. Now, this is an added layer of foregoing an association that a child has with his father or her father, which is very, very different from a relationship a child has with the mother. Now, how is it fair that you ask the child to undo that relationship just because you chose to change everything about yourself one day? And you're asking an entire world to just, you know, go per your whims and fancies. What was truly shocking to me was there are some countries where if I'm a child and my father is trans-identifying, he not only has the right to change stuff like his birth certificate and his other documents and things like that. In some countries, these parents have the right to change the birth certificate of the child, to change the fact that he's not a father anymore, but he is a mother, and things like that. I think all of this is a profound form of child abuse that, especially on children who can't verbalize this, it's going to be a scar on them for the rest of their lives. It's bad enough that you grow up in an abusive household, and now to have all of the things that you know to be real and true and evidence-based are now completely snatched away from you. And the decisions that you go on to make as you grow up are all going to be so messed up, because the concrete reality of a child is to have, if it is a heterosexual marriage, that is, to have a father and a mother, right? Now that's changed. That's completely, that fortress completely fallen to dust. And now you spend your life as an individual in a society, you interact with so many different sections of the society. Now, how do you interact with that has a very strong bearing on what kind of a home you're coming from. Now, it takes immense amount of conviction and grit for you to deal with that in a way that you compartmentalize that and live like an ordinary, regular person, functional person in the society. But that's not possible. One way or another, it'll come to you and it'll hit you really badly. Maybe not right away. Maybe when you grow up, maybe when you're 40, you know, you never know when this will come back to haunt you. And I think it is one of the most profoundly abusive things she can do to a child, to ask her to alter material reality when she's a child, when she looks up to you, for you to guide her as to how she should live her life. And you are the first person who completely shatters this image of the world, it's the reference that she was hoping to. You're not that anymore.
One of the things I explore is the erosion of positive masculinity. And do you think that this is a byproduct of men given really poor role models for starters, and also not given boundaries either for piss poor behavior? And they're now playing their fetishes and desires out to an extreme degree. Did you find an element of that in your research?
I mean, there are schools of thought where some of them have proven that violence or violent nature is innate in a person. And then there are some that say that it is a learned behavior. Now, if there are violent men in this world, and we know that there are, I wonder whether it would be fair to say that they could attempt to stop it, because there are reforms and there are ways in which people have undone the damage that they meted out to their family and relatives and things like that. Now, I wonder if these fetishes and these depraved things that they subject their wives to, it probably wouldn't have been this horrible if not for other elements acting to support it. For example, social media and the way all of the sections of society are now glorifying these men to be all these stunning and brave things, right? Now, they kept moving that boundary inch by inch, you know, and then now it has turned into this monster where you're not allowed to question anything within the realms of this trans ideology. And that includes these perversions, that includes the violent nature of what they're demanding of their wives. In India, rape, marital rape, is not a crime, because the person who has raped you is your husband. So I can kind of take references from a situation like that, where if your husband is trans, anything that he does to you is something that is supposed to be okay, because we live in a society like that. I don't know if there is any scope for men to reform themselves in a way that they start respecting women as equals. I don't know if that day is possible, because I'm seeing examples, very counterproductive examples of a future that looks very bleak. So how did we get here is not something I know. I know that it was not overnight. It was gradual. A lot of things were allowed, or rather not punished early enough, that these men feel entitled and are now walking with impunity, because it was not punished once. It is never going to be punished now. That's the kind of feeling. That's the kind of mentality these men have. And we know, because there are these very dangerous men who have been imprisoned for child rape and violent manslaughter and murder, are now asking to be put in women's prison. You know for a fact that their motives are very, very clear. I can't for the life of me understand how authorities are able to look past that and give them those sanctions and then allow them to be part of the female prison, who conveniently, once away from prison, change their identity back to male. I don't understand how an entire country or the entire world can be gaslighted in this manner. It can't be the case where they think it is all okay. I am sure it is the case where they know it's not okay, but they're just unable to do anything about it after a point.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. One of the things, you brought it up right at the beginning, and it was certainly something that I just wrote down here, which was cluster B personality disorders, particularly narcissism. That seems to be something that pops up again and again and again. And the other thing that also pops up, and I'm sure you saw this in your research for dysphoria, is the effect of other non-neurotypical disorders like Asperger's and autism. What sort of connections do they have to being able to be sucked into this ideology, or autogynephilia, which I know it was AGP, is the, yeah, yeah. Over that. That seems to be something that has become much stronger out in the open and not behind closed doors anymore. So it's not what I think, if you said to most people, this is what a transition looks like. I think they think to themselves, it's a Caitlyn Jenner on the cover of Vanity Fair. Whereas it's the truth of the matter is quite different, really, isn't it? It's very narcissistic, self-obsessed men that want to be the center of all attention all of the time.
Yeah, it's utterly funny to me how all the films that I'm making right now, just consider turfy or transphobic, you remove the trans element from that, I think the film would explain a lot of things just the same. Because we live in a world with narcissistic men surrounding us. We live in a world where men feel entitled for a lot of things, including sex from a woman to begin with. And that's why there is a rise of this movement, if I can call it that. I don't know if I can call it that, but the incel movement, the involuntarily celibate. What sort of a mental, I don't know, what sort of an aha moment must have given rise to a thought like this, where men think that they are not given sex, and therefore they become part of this community where they demand that they too deserve sex. Now, I can't for the life of me understand when was the last time a woman demanded that she should be, you know, should be given sex just because she was rejected by a few men. Women just carry on with their lives, you know. They're not forming groups of incel women anywhere. I haven't heard of that at all. So I think a lot of their behavior, you remove the trans thing, it would still be the same. But the trans thing has exacerbated that to a point where we are in a tipping point of an epidemic of male violence against women in this world. It doesn't matter which country you're from. It doesn't matter which rural, urban part of a country you're from. I think this experience is a universal experience of women. There might be some odd ones where they've grown up not experiencing all of this violence, good for them. But universally, this is the reality. And I think that pointing out trans, the dangers of trans, is one thing. I think deep down, what I've tried with my film as well, is I've pointed out the abuse under all of these things. This trans thing is a fad now. 10 years down the line, something new might come. 20 years later, something else might come. But the fact remains that women are considered to be objects that men think that they can wear and abuse and discard at their, you know, depending on their mood. I think ultimately, all feminists, all organizations, anybody who's critical of this ideology should bring it back to the center of what the root cause of all of these things, which is male violence against women. And I think many people are too afraid to call it that. And if you do call it that, they are not given the support that they're supposed to get, be it in therapy, be it in any other forms of support, in a support group, for example. They're not afforded that because the person who is abusing you is trans-identified. She might just be lucky to get some sort of a support if it was a regular kind of a domestic violence situation or drug abuse or alcohol abuse or an infidel partner, for example. She might get some sympathy from others. But when it comes to this one, people are generally just not sure what to say. And it is this lack of knowledge that is putting people away from their friends who are going through something like this. Every woman that I spoke to in the film, my had this period of isolation, of acute, profound isolation from the people that they thought were going to be there for them. I know what it feels like because I have been through that multiple times in my life. The friends, they just don't know what to say to you. And when you're married, your friends, their friends, his friends, they all blur into one, right? So it becomes really difficult for women to have their own set of friends and things like that. Now, I have, since making this film or understanding this ideology, what I have done is I've started strengthening my female friendships. And I have been constantly advocating for other women to do the same. Because whatever happens in your life today, tomorrow, whenever, doesn't matter, you need to have a trans spouse or anything like that. To even be hit by an ideology that is so gaslighting in its very core, you need to have somebody sensible to tell you that you're not going mad. Otherwise, this whole thing will collapse. We won't be able to have a straight head to be able to criticize this ideology for what it is. I think that was the most difficult part for me, to not lose myself, give myself into emotions and things like that, but just stay objective. Just say, I don't know, militantly objective, if you will, to point out things for what they are. Male violence. That's it. Mm. Male violence. This is male violence. This is gaslighting. This is male violence. You know, I think that kind of thread that I held on to while I was trying to not drown, you know, brought me to the shore somehow. And I think the film is able to speak to other women because they can see the root of it all rather than just look at it as a trans thing. It's not. It's a male thing. It's an abuse thing.
Well, it's like those labels, isn't it, that you get slapped with to shut down a conversation. And I think you're right. The minute you remove trans from the picture and you just look at what's left, what you have left is a male-dominated abusive relationship. So these women, where now do they go? Some of them have, I know, created groups to be able to bring each other together. Talk about that a little bit more, because I think that that in itself is quite hopeful.
Well, it is so hopeful. Much before I even started research on my project, transvideosvoices.org is a brilliant website. It's got resources from around the world, experiences of women from around the world. What it started doing was basically it started collecting stories as experiences of these women who were going through a marriage with a trans-identified man. So it started as just the founder herself, who's a trans widow, who started writing about her own experience, Tinsel. And then she started inviting other women to share their story. All of them are anonymous, and rightly so, because they might be doxxed and abused and they worry about their children's safety as well. So kudos to them just the same. But she started putting these stories together, and this became like a very powerful collection, a repository of experience that you have been trying to ignore. Now, it's like you might choose to ignore it, but it is there. If you don't look at it, it doesn't mean it's like saying you shut your eyes and believe that it is night, you know, or you've had dinner and you believe world poverty is gone. That's not how the world works. Mm. So these experiences are there. These women exist and their stories are just as real. You have just chosen to ignore them completely. But these women have continued to collect these stories. I think there are hundreds of stories on that website right now. Similarly, for children who are going through this from in the hands of abusive father, there's childrenoftransitioners.org as well, where Emma has been putting together her experience as well as a few others who are anonymous at this moment. So basically, the film is also part of that large repository of resource, which belongs to all of us. I consider most of my work to be a very democratic thing, where I want people to use my film as a way to start conversation or to send it to their MPs, or use that as a way to shut somebody up who's making an idiotic argument online, for example. So the support that they found each other by merely posting their story and seeing it there on the computer and knowing that there might be people who are reading it. And two things happen. One is she feels happy to know that she has poured it all out, one. And two, the knowledge that she might have helped somebody else. And I think that's so much more rewarding to her, because when she was going through it, that's what she was hoping for, some sort of a support, which she didn't get. So she talked about her experience on a website, and she hoped that other people might find that useful. And they did. And some of them have written their experience in a way that when they were in the abyss of going through this, through the divorce or the separation or whatever, it was this website or it was this woman's story that helped her to come back out of this abyss and try to rebuild her life, start all over again. I think our film is also going to be the same thing. And that's why in the end, even though I feel very, very pessimistic about everything concerning male violence, right? I am like that. I can be pragmatic about it. But then if you don't have hope, what can you do? That's why I ended the film also with a message of hope, where I want more of us to demand answers to not just this abusive behavior, but to just the historic abusive behavior that women have been experiencing. And hopefully, some point in future, probably not in my lifetime, but some point in future, there will be enough women who are self-sufficient and happy in their own skin, don't have to call themselves non-binary or this or that or 100 and something genders I don't even know about. They can just be females and amazing and take no bullshit from any form of male violence, be it trans, be it anything else. I hope that, you know, films like these, resources like these, pave the way for others to be able to speak truth and understand that this is the kind of world we live in. It's not a level playing field, but there is power in demanding justice, in saying no to abuse. And I hope that all these resources and the support system that we have for each other enables us to say no to that kind of abuse, so that if it were to happen to us, we seek that strength from all the stories we've heard, all the films we've watched, and say, even if we are afraid, even if we are terrified, even if by saying no, we are going to be subjected to more abuse, we would have said no. And I think that's powerful enough today. Tomorrow, it will be a bit easier. And the day after, a bit more. You know, that's how I see it.
Yeah. Yeah. And Helen Joyce actually described that beautifully towards the end of the film, didn't she? It was incredible. One of the things I wanted to ask you was the trans widows. And you also did your previous docuseries on young girls. And there's now a number of detransitioners that are starting to come out of that sort of craze of, you know, a decade or more ago. Are there similarities between these two groups of women? For me, having interviewed both detransitioners, especially detransitioners, is courage. That's one of the things that has struck me, is the tremendous courage that these young women finally have when they wake up and they go no, which is not an easy thing to do. Did you notice that, having worked on both projects, did you notice, what similarities did you notice between those two groups?
Well, I believe all of them are extremely formidable. And I think they have seen some very dark places before they are where they are right now, being able to speak coherently, explaining their experience in a way that other people are able to glean stuff from based on what they need. I think the only difference perhaps would be that for the detransitioners, I imagine you would need a profound amount of humility to admit that you were wrong in choosing that path. And it takes a lot of, I don't know, it takes a lot out of you to say that you were wrong, because it's not easy. Nobody likes to be wrong. And you try to make this one decision right by making more decisions that are even more detrimental. And I think I can speak, even without referencing to anybody, it's probably the case for most of the detransitioners now. They chose this and they have to maintain this facade. And at one point it becomes too much. And it is only then that they realize, oops, I might have gone down this rabbit hole a bit too far. How do I climb back out? I need air. So I think the first step would be to admit to yourself that you are wrong, and to admit to the world that you are wrong. That is some, you know, will of steel, to be able to admit that you are wrong and now say that, please don't make the same mistake I did. In the case of trans widows, of course, all of them are just as formidable. I think the one difference is the trans widows are not going to get that much of a support as the detransitioners are. That's just the truth.
Mm.
Because when you look at it, everybody hates on the ideology and they want to help people who are affected by the ideology directly. Now, if you are a detransitioner, you're the person who is a direct recipient of this ideology and how it wronged you, and you want to right that wrong. But the spillages fall in the rest of the society. We don't have time to help those at this point. So for the trans widows to come forward and speak, I think it is a matter of courage. It is a matter of grit, of course. But I think it is also a matter of frustration, because nobody wants to hear their story. I think that's the one tiny difference between the detransitioned women and the trans widows, because the damage that the wives have faced is not firsthand. Similarly, the children. So I suppose that's the one striking difference in my mind. And both of them should just go forward and speak about their experience and should be both heard, but with the context of how this might be slightly different. And while we have to support these poor women who went down this path, by the way, if I can point it out, that I understand completely that the nuance behind why women just choose to do this and why men choose to do this. And the support that we're offering to women is so much more calculated and beneficial for them, because we know that they're running away from womanhood.
Mm.
And that, again, if you really think about it, the root cause is male violence. Some of them could be gay, some of them could be autistic, some of them could be just coming from a very bad childhood. All of that brings us back to the very point that we started out with, male violence against women. So there is a lot of empathy for these young women who've gone down this path. But I think it's also only fair that we extend that amount of empathy to the other people who are affected by this ideology. Probably not directly, but the impact is just the same, if not worse, because they are in an intimate situation with these abusive men in a house that probably has children, with a knife on their throat that their children will be under, subject to abuse if they don't comply and affirm and things like that. I can't even start to wonder how much of a fear she should be experiencing on a minute-by-minute basis. You know,
mm-hmm.
like one of the characters says, will he just kill me when I'm asleep because he hates me so much? Will he just, if he gets violent, how many kids can I grab on the way out? These are not normal things that people say, you know. So I think it's fair that, of course, all of these experiences are important and we should talk about it. But I think the trans widows are put on a gagging order because the abuser is trans identified. And you're not even allowed to seek support. I think that's something that we need to ponder about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the film was just, I mean, it was incredible. And if I really do encourage people to hunt it out. So, which then begs the question, I watched this on X. Have you actually had a lot of challenges getting this film distributed because of the subject matter? What sort of barriers have you come up against? Or have you just gone straight to somewhere where you know that you can get it distributed, you can have it played, and it's available for people to access?
I believe that for films that you desperately want people to watch, you should make it very, very easy to watch, or easy to find, or easy for people to access it. This was a crowdfunded project, and I believe in making a film by people, for people, and you know, in the end, it becomes like a global resource that anybody can use. I knew for a fact that I wasn't going to receive any big distributors or anything like that, or even production companies interested in a project like mine. I just knew this from the beginning. So I didn't even seek support that way. It was completely democratic. I had donations, like $2 donations to $100 donations to $1,000 donations from women across the world. And I think the film is a result of all of those donations, especially those tiny ones that, you know, that matter, that trickle to bring you to the finishing stage in the end. Putting it on X was just, you know, another way in which people can watch it and distribute it easily, as opposed to linking it via YouTube and then sharing it. The only challenge that I have, unfortunately, is it's not deplatformed yet. The film is there. I suppose they are worried that, I mean, it is my guess that I'm brown. And if they take the film down, it might seem racist, I'm guessing. It's a speculation. So they've barely let the film be on YouTube, but they've made it impossible to find.
I went there to try and find it, and I'm thinking, oh, it says, I could see the YouTube link, and I'm thinking, I can't, well, where is it? And I put in a very specific search, and I'm thinking, okay, I'll ask about that. Right, so they've really shadow banned that sucker.
Yes, yes, they have, and you have to really search for my production company, go into my channel and find the film there. And, you know, for women who are probably not all that tech savvy, these extra steps prevent them from watching this film. And that's exactly what they want. Whatever little prevention that they're able to do, they're trying to do it. And I posted it on X as well, hoping that it would also be one of those reasons why people won't have difficulty finding it and things like that. On both places, it's difficult for me to monetize it because they've demonetized this film because apparently it's not suitable for some advertisers. Meanwhile, they are having ads played during my film. And those are ads that are supportive of gender ideology. And that really, really pisses me off. Not only have they made it difficult for women to find the film, and when they find it, they play ads that are exactly the ones that we are critical of through the film. So yeah, they are making money out of women's labor. Basically, it's just, you know, the story of our times, right? Nothing's new. 1960s, 1930s, and 2024 is all the same.
I know. Goes around, comes around, believe me. So just to recap, the best place for people probably to find it is on X. We will make sure that we've got all the links in the show notes. Is there also a place to, as you said, this is crowdfunded, that they want to, they've watched the film, they then want to actually give you a little bit of support for popping that out there. Can they find also that ability to on X as well to throw you a few shekels as the way of a thank you for watching the film?
Yeah, there are a couple of links like PayPal and Buy Me Coffee that I've added in my bio. But then again, X could give me the subscribe option, but it wouldn't give me. It's just been pending forever. Mm. The sad thing is you're paying for free speech to get the premium account. And yet you're gagged because they're not giving you subscription for being critical of this ideology. You're enabling free speech, but you're punished. Because they're making you pay money and they're not giving you the way to make it back. So, I mean, all those challenges aside, I think I would have done the same exact thing, even if I didn't make a single penny out of it. And I will continue making the film just the same. But it can be found on X. It can be found on YouTube. Just probably takes a few more extra typing of some keywords before you find it. But I will also try and upload all of the individual stories because they are there and it's like a gold mine. It would be really silly of me to not upload all of them. So they're all coming and eventually it'll be like this one big repository of stories of all these women. And then I think we shall see how much are they going to deny it or how much are they going to say that we're all liars or fascists or Nazis and whatever.
Oh, they'll think of something, Vaishnavi. They'll think of something. Don't you worry about that. Look, this has been just wonderful. I've been talking to Vaishnavi Sunda. She's the creator, producer, director of this wonderful documentary called Behind the Looking Glass. As we said, it's on X. I will make sure that we have the link for that in the show notes to make it nice and easy for you to find. Look, I really appreciate your time this morning. It's been an utter joy to speak with you.
Oh, such a pleasure talking to you as well. I hope we can stay in touch.
Yes, most definitely. And of course, we want you to stay in touch. If you've got some questions about anything you've heard this morning, inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email and 2057 is the text. Don't disappear. Your comments and feedback are coming up here very soon.
You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning. Welcome back to Counterculture here with Reality Check Radio. You're with Marie and joining me now from Florida, actor, director, producer, author and founder of the Sorbo Studios, Kevin Sorbo. Welcome back to New Zealand.
Yes, it's been a long time since I've been. I think I've been back about, the show finished back in the end of 1999. I was there for 7 years and I've been back maybe three times, but it's probably been 7 or 8 years since the last time I was down there.
Yeah. Well, if you were to come back now, you'd notice a few changes about the place.
I saw how your government treated people in COVID. I mean, we were pretty bad here, but boy, between you and Australia, that there was some crazy stuff going on.
Oh, yes. Well, according to our leader at the time, Ashley, I think she once famously said, "We like to do things differently here," and differently we did. Actually, and that in a way segues a little bit because we're going to cover a bit of ground today. And a lot of that obviously is movies and entertainment. But sure. one of the things I wanted to cover is two dates because I talk about culture in this space. And you have in a way had a cancellation from Hollywood, which you've talked about. And I have also been part of the cancel culture mob. One of the things that someone said to me recently was everybody needs to be cancelled because getting cancelled is a ticket out of your matrix. Have you found that? Has it been your ticket out of the matrix?
I've never heard that before. It's kind of interesting. I'm like, I think the first cancel culture victim in Hollywood before it actually became a term. My manager and agent 11 years ago called me in one day. I felt like it was an intervention because they never had the same town. One of them was in Beverly Hills. The other was on the side of the mountains in the Pasadena area. And they said, we can't work with it anymore because the things you're posting. I go, Oh, you mean because I'm posting the truth? That's a problem. But they said, well, things are getting worse here. Because I said, because I've never changed. I've been conservative my whole life. So, but Hollywood got less and less tolerant of it because they're the ones who scream for tolerance and freedom of speech. But as you know, just like America's government and pretty much like yours, freedom of speech and tolerance is a one-way street, unfortunately. I have no problem with people having opposite point of view from me. I don't harbor that kind of anger and hate that comes from the left. It's just crazy what's going on, but it's perpetuated by radio and television and movies. And, you know, Hollywood runs the culture, certainly in America, and has its far-reaching effect around the globe. So, yeah, it's just too funny for me. I formed Sorbo Studios, my wife and I, and we've been doing just fine without Hollywood. I shoot about four or five movies every single year. We do movies that Hollywood used to do, movies that have hope and love and laughter and hopefully a little redemption in there as well. But, you know, it's just weird to me what's happening in the world right now. It's just absolutely crazy. And it's all by design. They want more control of people's lives and people are letting them take control of their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, control is something that we certainly learned about firsthand down here. Let's talk about Sorbo Studios a little bit first, though.
Sure.
The stories that people used to be able to hear. These are the stories that you're telling. How do you find a story? What makes a good story to be told?
Well, you know, so many independent producers out there right now. I mean, Hollywood is fractured. They're trying to freak out too, because let's face it, technology is growing faster than all of us even keep up with. So there's so much opportunity out there to keep on working in an industry that I love. And, you know, I mean, we can raise about $3 million per movie. People go, wow, it's a lot of money. That's catering budget in Pirates of the Caribbean. Those are $300 million movies with a $100 million advertising budget. So that's the movies we got to compete against. But there's scripts come my way all the time through Sorbo Studios. But right now, we are so blessed. I've got my next six movies funded over the next 3 years that I'll be directing and acting in. I got three movies in post-production right now. I got three documentaries in post-production, and I've just been very fortunate to keep on working. So I get so many scripts coming through Sorbo Studios, and I keep posting, if you've got funding, I'll look at it. I'm not looking at anything new right now. I'm looking at stuff that I already have and that I'm going to be doing. That's where my focus is.
So do you think this desire for these stories is actually Hollywood's drop ball? They haven't actually read the room that there is a huge market out there for beautiful stories, well told.
And I think their ideology is so screwed up. I mean, like I said, I had a movie I did called Let There Be Light that my wife wrote. Dan Gordon, an Oscar-nominated writer, he wrote The Hurricane for Denzel Washington, White Earp, Kevin Costner. He wrote 60 episodes of Highway to Heaven from Michael Landon, came in and did the rewrite, did a great rewrite. We got it funded by people, by Sean Hannity. I'm sure people hate that Sean Hannity came in and funded it. But we shot this movie, and it opened number two per screen average. Here's a $3 million movie up against Thor Ragnarok, a $300 million movie. We opened up screen average number two. I get a call following Monday opening weekend box office. I get a call from Netflix, and they had me come into their studios in Hollywood there. And I had four meetings over the next 6 weeks with these guys about doing an inspirational division. It doesn't have to be faith-based, just movies that have good messages. You know, a couple steps above Hallmark, not cheesy or campy, just something that really had a good message in, had a good script in it, good acting. And after about 5 weeks, I could tell that they weren't going to do it. And I got in a room with all these bigwigs from Netflix, and I said, your ideology is so screwed up. You're so filled with anger and hatred because you've been brainwashed to be that way through the beating over the head for decades now through Americans' public schools and universities and television and movies, that you don't even want to consider. And I could tell half the people in the room were agreeing with me, but they're all afraid. They're all afraid to open their mouth. I just said, this is sad, guys. There's 80 million homes in America alone that want the kind of movies I do. I did a movie called God's Not Dead. $2 million budget, made $140 million in U.S. box office. $140 million. And yet they don't even want to even touch movies like that. That same year, Russell Crowe did a movie called Noah. And we got invited to Paramount to see it before it came out in theaters, the week before it came out. And my wife whispers to me, this isn't the story of Noah. This is Transformers meets Waterworld. And so I said, just wait now. It's going to open big because the faith-based crowd is going to flock to this because it's got Noah title to it. And I said, it'll drop 60% next week because word of mouth will be, don't go, it's a waste of time. It dropped 67% from week one to week two.
Yeah, yeah. And I look at other actors who have carved a path in this space and who have done some incredible things. So Jim Caviezel is one that is most recently with the
Sound of Freedom.
Yeah. That was a sleeper hit that Hollywood just simply didn't see coming.
Made $175 million in box office. Yeah, Jim Caviezel had the same manager for many years. We were neighbors up until 6 years ago. I tell people I escaped the state of California. I now live in the free state of Florida. We left literally the worst governor in the country for the best governor of the country. Down here, I never wore masks. The only time I had to wear a mask is when they force you to wear them on airplanes. But we didn't, you know, the attitude here is, wear them if you want. And now, of course, Dr. Fauci, who should be in prison for what he's done, he came out about 3 months ago and said, the 6 feet thing was made up and masks were pretty useless. So now they admit to it. Everything that Zuckerberg took me down for, the little wussy Zuckerberg for taking me down to Facebook, I'd like my 4 million followers back, please. But, you know, this is the world we're living in right now. And I tell people, please don't be afraid. I get actors come up to me, not even actors. I'll get camera guys, lighting people, hair and makeup people. Every movie I've been doing the last 6, 7 years, someone comes up and says, thanks for being a voice for us. And I go, be a voice for yourself. Stop letting fear rule your lives. But that's what that's what every government loves. Fear is their favorite weapon. And I think the biggest killer, in not only America, around the world, is apathy. I think people just given up. Yeah. The truth about Minnesota, I'm from Minnesota, but it's turned into California, but it's politics. The truth is the British monarchy treated Americans better 250 years ago. We went to war on 3% tax than our American government is doing right now, because they take half of your money and then what you get left over, everything you buy gets taxed as well. I mean, we tax the heck out of every single dollar we make in this country.
Yeah, well, believe me, we do down here as well. Yeah, it's hopeless. And so, let's face it, I mean, we've had the COVID years and they've been a bit like a bad nightmare. Yeah. Are you seeing a pivot now? I mean, look, we are now into October. Next month, the big show is on. Yeah. Are you seeing a pivot in the mood from 2016 to 2020 to 2024? What have you seen?
People there is a tipping point. There's no question. People are starting to wake up. Lions are starting to wake up. The sheep are going to be the sheep. But more and more people are vocalizing. Because the last 4 years of this government, which is a total hardcore socialist government, to let 20 million people, what is the population of New Zealand? 5 million?
Five and a half million.
We let 20 million people in this country come across the border. In the 4 years Trump was in office, it was below four million for the whole 4 years. This is five times as many people. They've already estimated 800,000 of these people are terrorists. They admit to the fact that they're now in America. I think we're going to have a 9/11 scale in every city sometime in the next 2 to 5 years. They're planning. They're very patient about it. We're going to have something horrific happen to this country because these people coming in. The amount of people getting attacked, raped, murdered from illegals, 475,000 reported attacks already. 475,000. What we're doing to this country is beyond evil, what our government's doing. And it seems to be, obviously, it's on purpose. And you're looking at Kamala Harris, who wasn't, when she ran for office 4 years ago, she had she didn't get one vote, didn't win one delegate. She didn't even make it to Iowa. She was the first of the 13 people running for the president's office against Trump in 2020. She didn't make it to Iowa. She was the first voted off by people in the Democrat Party. And what I find even more hilarious to me is that her only qualification is to be vice president, and these are Joe Biden's words, they're not mine. He said, my running mate will be a woman of color. That was her qualifications to be a woman of color. And how she got to be now the nomination, and they're painting her as this amazing person. And when we were in California, people knew about her. They called her Casting Couch Kamala because she's pretty much sleeping with everybody to work her way up the San Francisco and Sacramento political chain. So here we are. And this just proves that anybody can be president in America. That's what it proves.
Well, this is, looking at it from down here, because I track American politics. I lived in the United States as an exchange student. I was there at the breakup of the ANZUS Treaty. So being a New Zealander living in Midwestern United States, just off an Air Force base, right at the time when your prime minister leans over and says, we don't want your nuclear ships anywhere near our harbours and see you later, was a contentious time. What I was able to see was how what you have is a United States of really what are 50 very, very different countries. So whilst so then you've got always leading lights. I look at Kamala Harris now and I'm thinking, as you said, I mean, for me, she's somebody as a woman who's fallen upwards and managed to sleep her way to the top. Go feminism. No, I mean, it's sad, really. Yeah. And now you've got this Hollywood-style propaganda machine that has now catapulted her ahead of this election. When you're talking to people that you know, I mean, surely you must be, there must be those even more centrist liberals that are looking at this going with raised eyebrows, wondering what on earth is going on.
Oh yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, I know, look, I still got liberal friends. We get along just fine. We don't harbor hate towards each other. We give each other a hard time, but it's all, you know, guys giving each other a hard time. I sit there and watch what's going on within our political system right now. What's going on with, in terms of just the backlash. Look, when I meet people that disagree with me, and I say, well, what policies of President Trump during his 4 years did you not like? And they go, well, he's a jerk. He's an asshole. And I go, well, those aren't policies. Okay. And they're running on that. And the truth is, before he announced himself as a Republican candidate, he was a registered Democrat. Mm. And everybody wanted him on their late night talk shows. They all, well, Hollywood, please do a cameo on my TV show or my movie. They all loved the guy. The minute he went down that road, they just went after him, just vilified the guy. And I love they call him a Nazi. Number one, Nazi stands for National Socialist. He's hardly a National Socialist to begin with. And they use that Nazi term so freely, it doesn't make any sense. But if you ask people, be honest now, were you better off during those 4 years than you've been the last 4 years? And if they are honest, of course they were. We were energy independent. We were doing our own oil. This whole climate hustle, climate warming thing it's ridiculous to me. The trillions of dollars we're throwing out there. You think India or China care about what they're doing in terms of pollution? Our country now, our world right now is in dire need of not to get less carbon. We need more carbon. I saw a 450-year pattern that supposedly came out from whatever they're studying as scientists. And we're at one of the lowest peaks we've ever been right now. So to me, that's a whole other issue we can talk about. But I just think it's ridiculous. I call climate change weather. That's what it is. They're called seasons, kind of what it is. Just 10 years ago, they thought we were going to another ice age here in America because we had the coldest decade and we're like since the 1970s. So I just find it sad, this whole power and control thing happening, and people afraid. Once Biden got in office, he took away our resources of drilling oil. Well, what do? We buy oil from the Middle East. So we fund our own wars against ourselves. That's what we're doing. Yeah. We're paying countries that hate us to have oil when we got so much oil in America and up in Alaska, which is part of America, but there's so much untapped oil up there. And these people that want to get rid of oil, then maybe they need to start living the lifestyle, getting rid of their iPhones, getting rid of the computers, getting rid of a lot of their clothes, getting rid of toothbrush, hairbrush, vacuum cleaner. There's oil in all these products. I think people are so ignorant that what oil is being used for.
The film that you had produced just recently, which was The Miracle in East Texas, have I got that title correct? Right. Correct. Which was centered around the discovery of oil in the 1930s, and that was a true story. Right. And I just sort of read the synopsis about it, but there was almost a parable effect in that story. They say, what is it, the history doesn't repeat, but sometimes it rhymes. Do you find that when you're starting to tell some of these stories, that there are themes that appeared 100 years ago that are all of a sudden reappearing today?
Well, history will repeat itself because in America, we're changing history. We're not even teaching proper history anymore. We're tearing down statues because, you know, George Washington had slaves back then. Well, back then it was the norm. Was it bad? Was it horrible? Yeah, it was. But we abolished it just like the rest of the world did. So, and unfortunately, there's a lot of slavery going on in the Middle East right now, and people aren't paying attention to that whatsoever. But Miracle in East Texas, a wonderful true story. I got to direct it. I starred in it along with John Ratzenberger and Lou Gossett Jr. is Lou's last movie before he passed away. And it's a wonderful movie telling the true story about these two con men that would woo widows out of their money on fake oil wells. And they would sell 500% of the shares, and they declare dry hole, move on. They strike oil in Kilgore, Texas, largest oil find in the history of the world. It made all the local people during that time, right in the heart of the Great Depression in 1930, made all these people very, very wealthy, black and white alike at that time in that area. It was, the oil rush was back on in full force during that time. So it's a wonderful movie. It's I hope people get a chance to see it. I know it ran theaters here in America and Canada and some countries in Europe. I don't know if it made it down to your neck of the woods, But I was grateful to be part of that movie. I did another movie called Left Behind, Rise of the Antichrist, based on the Left Behind books that sold 80 million copies back in the 90s. And to me, it's fascinating. It's basically based on the book of Revelation in the Bible when the second coming happens. And, people can take it for what it's worth and call it a fairy tale. But it's interesting read if they read the book of Revelation. You don't have to be a Christian to read it. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Another film that you appeared in recently, which is making a lot of sort of waves, I think, in the conservative space, is Reagan.
Sure. Yeah.
I had a quick look at that and I saw Rotten Tomatoes gave it 18%, but the Popcornometer gave it 98%. Is that a classic example again of Hollywood just simply not reading the room?
Oh, of course. They never saw the movie. Look, every movie I do, because it's family friendly and sometimes it's faith-based, they give it a 26% rating or lower. They just throw a slap of the thing on there. And then the audience, they give it 75% or higher. So it's just, that's run by total atheists, total socialists, and it's so blatantly obvious what they do. The Reagan movie is really quite good. I'm a little bummed out because they took out six of my scenes, but it's because we shot his whole life. You know, it came out to be about 4 hours long in all the edits. They had to get it down to 2.5 hours. So they got rid. I play as pastor to Reagan when he was a teenager and college student. So they had to cut all that out because they really wanted to get to Dennis Quaid when he was in his 30s, 40s, and beyond. Dennis did a great job. Penelope Ann Miller as Nancy did a great job. It's a wonderful movie. And it's not this whole conservative movie. It just shows the life of this man and how he got to where he is. It's a very strong movie, and it's very, very well done. It's directed by Sean McNamara, who Dennis and I worked together about 10 years ago in a movie called Soul Surf, from the life of Bethany Hamilton, the girl at 13 years old who lost her arm to a tiger shark attack. So it's I've been very fortunate, after Hollywood booted me out, to be still part of some really wonderful movies down the road here.
Yeah, that film, and I mean, Ronald Reagan especially, was somebody who, I mean, I think he had one of the greatest majorities in the modern era in terms of re-election.
Yeah, he got 49 of 50 states he won.
Yeah, so he was also a tremendous orator.
Yeah.
I mean, I listened to some of his old speeches recently, and also off the cuff.
Like, he's funny.
Very funny, very smart, leaves the like of Barack Obama dead.
Yeah.
Where do you find a politician with that sort of humility, humor, and gravitas in the modern era?
It's hard. It's hard to find that. I think the majority. So both parties have moved to the left over the decades. I think it was Brezhnev when he was president in Russia when he said, "We don't need to bring socialism or communism to America. It will find its way there, and it's found its way here." And you've got politicians. I tell people to look at John F. Kennedy's inauguration speech in 1960 online. It's quite fascinating because if you listen to that speech, there's not one Democrat who talks that way today, and very few Republicans that talk that way today. He would be a Republican. There's no question he would be a Republican. And even his famous quote during that speech is on his gravestone saying, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." Well, they don't do that in Washington, D.C. They want you to sit back and be a good little worker bee and be happy with the money you get to keep. They know how to spend your money better than you do. And, we keep throwing money at other countries when we have so many problems within our own. And I can't think of the untold billions we've given Ukraine when we have so much happening here in America along our border and along our public education system, which, of course, is run by the government. Speaking of a Reagan quote, he said, "These are the greatest words to fear. Hi, I'm from the government and I'm here to help." That's one of my most favorite quotes from him because it's so true. They're not there to help. Our founding fathers are flipping over in their graves for what our government is now doing to us. And once again, I think people are so apathetic that they just have given up, and we keep giving an inch to this government every week. Well, that inch adds up to millions of miles after all the decades that they've been taking advantage of the American people.
Yeah. So then you've got currently a natural disaster unfolding in North Carolina. Yeah. And having been in a region, we had a massive cyclone here 18 months ago. It was huge, and we're still recovering as well. So I can certainly appreciate what's going on up there. That is, North Carolina is one of, according to Charlie Kirk, three very key states in the upcoming election. Sure. North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Georgia are the three that he outlined. Right. What impact now, I mean, are the government, are the, what efforts are the current administration now applying to North Carolina? From what I've read, it's not been necessarily enough. And there's criticism at the money, the billions of dollars still heading across to Ukraine that potentially could be stopped and sent at home.
Well, I think of those billions of dollars we keep sending over there, I think half that or more comes back to these government officials, these people that are promising all this money. There's so much corruption in our government. It's unbelievable. People are so blind to what's happening. When somebody like Nancy Pelosi goes in for a job, she's been there 30, 40 years, whatever she's been. How is she worth $200 million now? It's already proven there's a lot of insider trading, you know, Wall Street and these senators and Congress people. We need term limits, number one. You shouldn't have, if the president gets 8 years max, nobody gets more than 8 years. Enough of this stuff with these lifetime people, because all they do is take care of themselves. They don't care about the human population. But here's the reality. That earthquake, that hurricane hit here as well. We had a lot. I'm on the East Coast, but on the West Coast, my brother and sister-in-law, my wife's sister, they lost their house. They've been in that house for 35 years. They lost the house. So they're in the demolition process right now. So it nailed a lot of people. I'm leaving on Thursday here. I think it's Wednesday where you're at, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, we're Tuesday afternoon here about 6 o'clock. So I'm leaving to go speak up in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I called them yesterday. I said, do you guys still want me to come up there to speak? And they said, oh, yeah, we got a lot of damage, but not nearly what other places in North Carolina did. So I'll be flying up there. It's interesting and sad to see the money go in the wrong direction, and they keep doing it over and over again. So you all know there's more to it than meets the eye. And I think one of the blessings of the internet, and the, you know, I think there's a lot of evil about it too. It's a wild west still, but the blessings of it, that news gets out there awfully quick, and there's a lot of people that can't hide as easily as they used to. So the incredible thing to me is the open hypocrisy of our government officials. They don't care what they say. They don't care if they lie. We all know they're lying. I got a quick story to tell. I was at a charity golf event just north of where I live here in Florida. And I was in the gym working out, and in walked President Obama with three of his Secret Service guys. And I was leaving alone. And one of them said, the president would love to meet you. And I'm going, he obviously doesn't read my Twitter feed, but okay. So and I said, I won't be a jerk, you know? So I walked up. I mean, he is a great speaker. I'll give him credit for that. And, I shook his hand and I said, are you golfing in the tournament with us here? And he said, no, I'm golfing with Michael Jordan at his course, which is north there. I said, hi to Michael. I played golf with Michael. I said, so what's your handicap? Well, he goes, now that I'm not, you know, president, I'm able to golf more. I said, dude, you golf more than any other president during your presidency than anybody else. And I said, and I'm not cutting you down for that. If I was president, I'd golf every day. The press can walk with me, give me a red line hot phone. I can still do stuff on there because I'm a golf nut. So anyway, I said, what's your handicap? Don't lie to me. He said, oh, I never lie. And I looked at him. I put my hand on his shoulder. I said, Mr. President, you're a politician. That's all you guys do is lie. And he laughed because he knows. He knows more than anybody else.
What did he claim his handicap was?
He said he was an 8. So I said, I'm a 5. So I said, I'll give you 2 aside. Let's see what we do against each other. So I thought it was pretty funny.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he played a lot of golf with John Key, our former prime minister, who was here for 9 years. And John was a massive golfer, and they were neighbours together in Hawaii.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So there you go. There's a little snippet, and of course,
well, you know, I know Craig Heatley. You probably know who Craig Heatley is. He's a New Zealander. I think he owns all the cable, the Sky Sports, and stuff.
Yes.
And
that. Yep.
Yeah, he gets over here once. Now, can people see us or not see us?
Most of this is going out on audio, but we do video clips.
Okay. I was just curious.
Yeah.
I was going to show you who I golf with a lot. There's me with the president right
there. Oh, look at that. Well, then, of course, so let's talk about that because, I mean, golf.
Yeah.
Came up the other week because the Secret Service discovered somebody poking in the bushes that thought that they would take another crack. What fallout or even coverage has been on the ground in the United States around these assassination attempts? Because to me, it seems to be a bit of a vacuum. No one appears to really want
to
talk about it.
It's unbelievable. Look, everybody's saying, why do we know more about this first guy? Because one turn of the head, he would be dead right now. And they treat it, the left, the media, our current government, treats it like a fender bender in a parking lot. If this had happened to anybody on the Democrat side, they would have the answers who's behind this. We all know who's behind this, but nobody's saying. So here's my conspiracy theory. I'll just say,
you're in a friendly listening space here, Kevin.
No, I know. I don't have to fill in a thing. We all know who's behind this because that punk did not act on his own. And they got rid of him very quickly, did they not? Because now it's come out, because all the conspiracy theories about Kennedy being shot, it's now come out that the CIA was behind it. So yeah. People can put the alphabet together themselves and try to figure it out. But for them to hide this and to get rid of the body right away, and this kid had no social media, a 20-year-old kid, are you kidding me? There's not one kid in the world that doesn't have an iPhone or a computer that's not on the social media all the time, whether they're watching porn or actually doing something constructive. They all have social media.
And the guy, Ruth, I mean, one of the questions, I speak to Trevor Loudon. I don't know whether you're aware of Trevor, but he's a political analyst, commentator and writer based in Florida, New Zealander. So he's Trev's my go-to politics man.
I know of him, sure.
Yeah. So Trevor, his question, him and I were talking about this the other day, and his question was, is no one is asking, how did this guy know that the president was going to be there that day? Because he wasn't scheduled to play golf. It was a last-minute decision.
That was exactly. Because once again, we know it's behind us. The picture I just showed you is that golf course. In the background, that's the waterfall in the 17th hole. But on he was on the 5th and 6th hole there, which I know quite well. And so I know that I play that course at least once every 2 months. It's a very private course. It's $350,000 US to join. So I think I'd rather go to a little cheaper place. But
you wait for the invitations and pop up.
I keep saying, I go, Donald, give me a celebrity discount. Come on, man. So, but I'll tell you what, I golfed with him. Look, he golfs very quick. I've been with him on that course. They have 6 Secret Service guys, 2 guys that go ahead that they found the guy with the gun, 2 that stay with him and 2 stay behind. He golfs fast like I do. He likes fast golfers. He went 18 holes in about 2.5 hours. People that know golf know that's fast. Most people take 4 to 5 hours. So anybody on that course knows when those 2 guys come up ahead, they do what they're checking to make sure everything's safe. And then they'll go on the people on the golf course. They say, can you please move over? The president's coming through. And they know the rules. They move over. We hit. He gets over there. He gets out of his golf cart, shakes all their hands, thanks them all for being there, says, God bless you guys, have a great day of golf, and have a good round. And they go ahead. You think any other president in America would do that? There's no way. Yeah. There's no way. He's a very funny guy. If they can watch Greg Gutfeld's show somehow over there, watch the interview he did with Greg last week. It was very entertaining, very relaxed, and very funny.
The debate, the vice presidential debate is coming.
It's tonight.
It is tonight, as we record this. And
I'll make popcorn.
So I was an exchange student in Ohio, so I naturally have an affinity for J.D. Vance, and knowing the area that he writes about in his book, Hillbilly Elegy.
Where were you in Ohio?
So I was in a little town called Fairborn, Ohio, which was just outside of Dayton, and it was the main service town for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Oh, okay. I get up to Columbus, Ohio a lot. I play in a charity event every year up there with Jason Day, who's an Australian golfer, but he plays in the PGA in America, and he married an American. They just had their 4th kid. So it's a beautiful area. I'm a Big Ten guy, too. I grew up in Minnesota, so we just recently played against Michigan. We lost by 3 points. It was a good game, though.
But, I mean, I'm looking at J.D. Vance, and it's funny, you know, like Tim Walz they've sort of like tried to give him the male version of the mumsy sort of vibe. And then you've got J.D. Vance, who is, I mean, he has got some swagger. He's certainly a bright guy. He has come from nothing. I mean, they can't lay at his feet that he has been raised with privilege. He is an epitome of what I call the Midwestern American dream.
Yeah, Midwestern redneck.
So how important, how crucial do you think that this vice presidential debate would be? Usually a debate that is dismissed. Does it have more gravitas this time around, given what has happened in the last 2 debates?
You know, I hope it does, because, I mean, Vance speaks very, very well. He's going to destroy Walz in the debate. He is. I mean, the trouble is, I think the debate that Harris did with Trump, I think Trump missed a lot of opportunity there. I don't get it. I don't know why he's just off his game or something like that. But if you get Kamala off, I mean, 7 days of rehearsing and getting the questions ahead of time. Here's another thing. They found out she was given the questions ahead of time. They didn't give Trump the questions ahead of time. So every time we do these debates, these presidential debates, the people hosting the event and asking the questions, all far left liberals. Why can't Fox do it? Why does every single time it's got to be someone who believes in socialism? It's a weird thing to me. So every debate Trump does, he's debating 3 people because they fact check him. They don't fact check Kamala. So it's I think it's tonight. I think it's going to be. I think a lot of people would tune in because they're just kind of curious because it is. Doesn't always work it that way, but most people that make it to the vice presidency, if they certainly get two terms in as vice president, they're usually the one that becomes the one running for president the next time around.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's qualified. I think he's qualified. He's a smart, smart guy. Mm.
Charlie Cook the other day said that he feels the campaign is in a better place than what they were in 2020, which is good.
Yeah.
He still believes that with the power of the media behind, because really at the end of the day, they're the third party, aren't they, in the race? The legacy media. We had that down here too. He still sees it as very 50-50, but he's vastly more optimistic. If President Trump doesn't get over the line, what fears do you have for the United States moving forward?
Well, my fear is, I think the last election was obviously stolen. There's a great documentary out there by Dinesh D'Souza, 2,000 mm-hmm. Mules, which I highly recommend. It shows it right there. Look, if you're going to have mail-in voting, there will always be cheating. It's just who does it better. And they're far more organized in their hate and their anger than the right is. I think that a lot of people on the right are a bunch of wussies as well. We need more masculine men out there not to be afraid. And you know, this whole attack on masculinity is so stupid to me. So my son wears a t-shirt that says embrace masculinity when he goes to the gym. I think it's so funny. But they're going to try to cheat in this one even more, because there's no way Kamala is actually someone who could run the country. And there's no way that foreign leaders would be, they laugh at her. Of course, somebody like Putin would love her to get in there. But, you know, we all know that any president gets in, there's a lot of people behind them that are pulling the cords as well. So, you know, it's, I tell people to vote and hope that they count it. I hope Christians vote, because 50% of Christians don't vote every year, which is amazing to me. So, you know, get out and vote. If you're not going to vote, you got no complaint. But, you know, in America, to have mail-in voting is so stupid. And to say that showing an ID to vote is racism? How is that racism? So I tell anybody black that I meet that gets in this conversation with me, I say, they're telling you, the Democrats telling you, that you're too stupid to be able to get an ID. I've yet to meet a black person who doesn't get on an airplane. Mm. Every time I fly a lot, they pull out their ID to get on an airplane just like I do. So it's weird what's going on, but we need people not to be afraid, and they need to get out there and you know, pull that lever and just, I don't know. But why are we not getting rid of mail-in voting is something I'm bringing right away. Get rid of mail-in voting. Get rid of the terms. There's only term limits for everybody. Start drilling oil right now. There's a lot of things I'd change. Build the wall, okay? Build the bloody wall. Be done with it. Come to America, but come to it legally. Like my grandparents came to America from Norway legally, you know? I mean, when I was living in L.A., I met many Mexican Americans that said that are mad at what's going on. They're mad that these people are just abusing the system. And we're giving them money. We're giving them phones. We're busting them to different cities across the country. I mean, it's just crazy what we're doing.
You mentioned masculinity before, and again, this show, they generally talk about this culture. So I talk about a lot about the erosion of positive masculinity. And I've got two sons. My sons are 16 and 18. So as a parent, I'm wanting to make sure that as two young men, they're not taught that they're toxic. They're actually vital, important, bright, wonderful young men. You've got a couple of sons. How have you instilled that in your sons?
By example, what my father taught me. My father was a tough farmer growing up as a kid, whose father was a farmer on the farms in Iowa. He was unable to play sports. He would have been a good athlete, but he was the only child. They couldn't have any more kids when all these other farmers are having seven, eight kids. So he had to miss out on sports. He had to do farm work early in the morning, go to school, come back, and do it till the sun came down. So he had four boys, and he lived vicariously through us. All of us were good athletes growing up through high school and college. And so to me, it's like... my boys are awesome. I'm 6'3". They're 6'4" and 6'5". Both of them are bigger and taller than me now. And trust me, they work out all the time. We are gun owners, beyond gun owners. Trust me, we shoot a lot. We can shoot on our property. We're in horse country here. We are First and Second Amendment people that believe that freedom of speech and the right to bear arms is very important. And our founding fathers, by the way, set that up. Not only for hunting, but they set that up in case there was a government that went against the people. That was the whole idea behind it. Does he want to look at, you look at what Hitler did. He took the guns away from all the people in Russia and China and Germany. I mean, look what happened.
Yeah, that is certainly the case. And also too, I mean, you played a character through those 90s that was the ultimate of fantasy masculinity.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think Hercules would even be able to be made in today's environment?
Oh, no, they'd make him transgender, I'm sure. Why we got to bend over backwards so less than 1% of the population is weird to me. I don't care what people do in their private and sexual lives. I could care less. Honestly, I'm in Hollywood. I've worked with gay people in every movie set and TV set I've been on in 40 years. You're not going to find one that's going to come out and say, he was so mean to me and evil to me. Because I'm not. I don't care. But it's just weird what we're doing right now. We give so much power to that. I go, why does Pride in America get a month and our veterans get one day? That makes zero sense to me. The veterans and your country, our country, all these countries, they're the ones who brought freedom to those countries to be, have a Pride month. But to me, make it a Pride day. A Pride month just makes no sense to me. It's zero. It's just weird to me that we're doing this. And we treat our veterans like crap in this country. And the veterans gave so much to so many countries over the centuries that it's just sad to me. I do a lot of speaking events. And I always have all the police officers, first responders, and all the vets from every armed force, please stand up and be recognized. They do that every place I go. And I will always say, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for being here tonight to support this cause. And if I just use your wrong pronouns, I don't care.
Which is what, again, makes it so amazing that Netflix did not want to engage in doing inspirational programming when they have got someone like Ricky Gervais, who doesn't care about any of this stuff. He's amazing. So it's like,
you know what? He's a socialist, and but he's also a capitalist at the same time. He likes being wealthy, but he's also an atheist. But I'd love to meet the guy. I think he's brilliant, and I think, you know, from his TV shows to his stand-up specials, I think the guy is spot on with the hypocrisy. And if you remember, I think it was the Golden Globes. I think, didn't he do it like four or five times and he laughed at it? And the last time he did it, he said, I know all you people out there are very, very, very nervous, you know, but I've changed, not as much as Bruce Jenner, but I've changed. He's not afraid. And he said, you guys are such whores that if the Taliban had a film fund, you'd be the first to line up. And everybody got nervous laughing about it, but it's the truth. They would line up.
I think one of the most, I actually watched the clip fairly recently, and it was the image of Tom Hanks, who had a face like a smacked cat's ass. You know, it was hilarious.
So funny.
And I think it's brutal honesty. There has been this lack of freedom of speech.
Yeah.
And thank goodness Elon has come out. And then just finally before we head off, because I know you're a busy man.
By the way, he's retweeted me about a dozen times over the last couple of years. So please follow, if Elon Musk is following me, please follow me at KSORBS.
Yeah, because you look at now, like if I were an independent voter in the United States today.
Sure.
Firstly, what do they look like? Because now you look at Tulsi Gabbard, Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Bobby Kennedy Jr.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost, you know, what an intriguing group of people who have come together to basically say, hey, wake up.
Yeah.
There's something really going on there. I mean, if you're an independent voter right now in the United States, what do those voters look like? Who do you think those people currently are?
You know, I know they're out there. I know a couple of buddies who are independents. They're going to vote for Trump. They get past all of the stuff the media is saying, this guy's mean, he's horrible, he's evil. He is not. The guy's done so much for this country. I've always said, 20 years ago, I said, I want a businessman running the country. I don't want a politician running the country. I want somebody who knows how to balance a budget, somebody who knows how to do business. Leaders, the evil leaders around the world, when you pull up Putin, you want to pull people in the Middle East and all that, they fear Trump because with Trump, there's no BS. There's no BS. He says, that's the way it's not going to happen. And I like that in somebody. I like that the guy that's not afraid to stand up and speak the truth. You can hate him all you want. You can hate all the brainwashing that you've been listening to the last, you know, 10 years through the media and through television and movies. I mean, good God, you can tell that people are getting sick of the movies Hollywood's putting out. Disney lost $1.4 billion last year.
Mm.
That's not a good business model if you're losing $1.4 billion. So America is at least starting to stand up, and more people are saying enough is enough, guys. You know, it's just ridiculous what we're doing. So I think the independent voters out there, I think the vast majority of them are probably going to Trump's way. There's a lot of people that will vote for him, but not tell their neighbors they're voting for him.
Right.
Just the stuff that comes out all the time. But to me, it's like, I hate saying I want to vote for the lesser of two evils, but that's really what it comes down to in a lot of ways and a lot of elections. Look, I voted for Reagan both times. First time I could vote in 1980, I voted for Reagan. My parents were, how could you vote for Reagan? Because they were Hubert Humphrey, Walter Mondale, Minnesota Democrats back then. And I said, well, they'd be Republican today. But I voted for Bill Clinton the second time around because I thought, you know, I thought he did a good job. So I guess you could say I'm an independent voter. But I think it's gotten so bad now that if you're independent, I think you got to vote Republican because of what the Democrats are doing to the country, period.
Yeah. So if people want to, A, check out the production work that you're doing, and B, check out some of those pithy comments that you have on X, where can they find you, Kevin?
Well, they can go to the X, they can find me at KSorbs or Instagram. Instagram, I'm more family friendly. And X, I'm a little more sarcastic humor. But KSorbs, KSORBS, but also sorbostudios.com. I always get a kick out of these people. I got like 2.2 million followers on X. And I don't really look at people, what people say. My sons do. And they say, you know, 95% people love what you say. And there's that 5% that just follow me to hate me. And I feel sorry for the people like that. I go, my God, if I disagree with somebody, I wouldn't sit there and wait all day long for them to post to attack them and wish that they would die. And that's what they do to me, which totally cracks me up. And all they do is affect their own selves. It doesn't affect my life whatsoever. They're the ones who dig that dark black hole they live in and make their lives more worse and worse and worse. To be filled with anger every single day, what a horrible way to live your life.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever have that Ricky Gervais moment when you think, no, I shouldn't be doing this? But then you do.
Then you do. Oh, yeah. Of course. Of course.
Yeah.
But but it's just, you know, to me, it's like I'm going to keep posting stuff that's true, but I will put a sarcastic little quinge to it as well. But, you know, I'm coming back down there someday. I told my family, we got to get down there. I walked the Milford track four times. I want to do it with all my kids and my wife.
Yeah, and we have a stunning golf course here now in Hawke's Bay, the farm, considered one of the best golf courses.
Oh, I don't know that one. I was a member at Titirangi Country Club outside of Auckland. Titirangi was a Mackenzie course.
Yeah, no,
and I golfed a lot of courses around there. I did Cape Kidnappers and I did Cowrie Cliffs before I left. And
so Cowrie Cliffs, the farm, Kidnappers. Yeah, so the Cape Kidnappers, it's the same people that both.
Right, beautiful. Same guy.
Yeah, same guy. Beautiful. Lovely. Yeah. All right, Kevin, it has been an utter joy to talk to you today. Thank you very much for your time. This has been Kevin Sorbo from Florida here on Counterculture with Reality Check Radio. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you so much. Let's get together soon and talk again.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Here's a selection of some of the feedback received. What is the crucial difference between politicians now and 100 years ago? And followed up on that comment, the same commenter, yes, why have they become so self-absorbed, or has that always been the case? And the rise and fall of our leaders, doctors, lawyers, and politicians. Yeah, certainly an erosion of trust. And Ramesh, actually, Robert, writes about this a lot. You can read a lot about that on the Brownstone Institute. He writes so beautifully there. From the text machine again, love you, Marie. Your interviews are fantastic, especially Ramesh the Kerr. Thank you so much. From Liz, hi, Marie. I just listened to your interview with Jared Van Berkel. Thanks for having him on. It was an excellent interview. I recently watched Mana Atua at the local church, and it was eye-opening and encouraging too. I've seen some of the clips of it previously, so I had an idea of what to expect. Nonetheless, there was plenty more for me to learn and take in. Understanding the trauma behind the behaviour and understanding that these men and women who have had unbelievable pain and brokenness in their lives enables me to see them in a different light, to have compassion for them and to see them as human beings. My life has been so insulated in so many ways, which is good, I have to say. I have had a wonderful childhood with a loving family around me, so I can't relate what those who embrace gang life have been going through. I agree with the gang being a version for family for them. We all desire and long for connection one way or another. As a Christian, I can now pray more specifically and with compassion rather than judgment for those in the gangs. Love your interviewing style too. What a lovely way of speaking and asking thought-provoking and deep questions. Regards, Liz. Well, thank you so much, Liz. I do appreciate the comment. Jared's work was incredible, and the film will be going out. He's hoping to get it, as he said, all sort of tidied up for international release. So if you didn't get to see it through those church screenings, do watch out for it by following them, Fantail Studios, on YouTube, so then you can see when they'll be making the general release for the film. More comments from Facebook on Jared's interview. Amazing film, well worth watching. We'll definitely listen to the interview tomorrow, and that's from Linda. And agreed from Liz. Agreed, eye-opening and inspiring. There is hope for anybody. Lee asked, where can the film be viewed? And yeah, as I mentioned before, hopefully if you follow Fantail Studios on YouTube, you will get to see when the film will be more readily available. So check that out. So again, thank you to everybody that sent in feedback to the show. We'd love to hear your comments. And of course, you can text me on 2057 or email us to inbox@realitycheck.radio. Hey, I also had a great time on the Foundation Members Call on Sunday. It's always really good to chat with the other hosts and catch up with you all in sort of a more relaxed environment. If you want to know more about the Foundation Members Club and all the benefits that goes along with it, just mosey on over to our website, realitycheck.radio, for more information. And Natalie Cutler-Welsh is waiting in the wings with Up Your Brave. Before I hand you over to Nat, it's time for a retro-banging high school hit. Here's the Choir Boys with Run to Paradise, and I'll be back here tomorrow with Marty Gibson for Media Matters. Catch us live from 1. Have a great day, and I'll see you all tomorrow.
You've been listening to Counterculture
with Marie Buskey
on RCR,
Reality Check Radio.